Last year, Adam and I and a few hundred friends of DeSoto gathered in the Masonic Lodge inside a cemetery in the heart of Hollywood. Were we there to practice some dark rite? Some sinister ritual designed to bring deceased Star Trek actors back to the plane of the living? To bring an unholy horde of undead nerd celebrities to Earth to consume the brains of the living? No, we were just doing our live show of the Share Your Embarrassment Tour. It's our review of Star Trek V, and we filmed it. We just wanted to let you know to get ready for that live stream announcement coming next week. If you're a Max Fun member and you support our shows, you'll get access to discounted tickets from membership at MaximumFun.org. So, good time to make sure those emails are delivering properly to your inbox. Either way, we'll be announcing ticket links soon here and on our mailing list that you can sign up for at podshop.biz. The Share Your Embarrassment Tour is coming to your living room for one last stop, and you're not going to want to miss it.
Captain!
Not here.
Captain! Report. Signatures detected.
Shields up.
Signatures detected.
Red alert.
Context Starfleet Command.
What's happened?
Context Starfleet Command.
Delay that order.
Context Starfleet Command.
This is the captain.
Context Starfleet Command.
Get out of my chair. Chair.
We have engaged the Klingons.
Klingons?
Welcome to The Greatest Discovery. It's a Star Trek Discovery podcast by the makers of The Greatest Generation. I'm Ben Harrison.
I'm Adam Pranica.
Adam, we did something kind of weird for this episode. We read some comics.
Yeah, something that I haven't personally done with any regularity for a long time.
When I first got my iPad, back when iPads were pretty new, maybe 2014, I thought, maybe this will be the thing that makes it easy for me to read comics, because I've always been a read-before-I-go-to-bed person,
mm-hmm.
and I was buying it with the idea that I travel a lot for work, and I would like to take a book with me to read before I go to bed, and the, e-reader functionality of the iPad was the thing that I got it for, but I guess whatever was going on with presenting comics on screen at that time was pretty weak sauce, and it seems to have come a long way. I really liked this Comixology app that we used to read this.
Yeah, outside of a few hiccups I had in just the purchase of a comic and its download using that app.
Yeah, thanks for making me tech support at 8 o'clock this morning, by the way.
I love how you got on the line and you were like, thank you for calling Comixology tech support. My name is Benjamin.
Your problem is very important to me.
Yeah. No, you were no help at all, Ben. I figured it out on my own. I was...
Yeah, kind of like how I figured it out on my own and didn't bother you with it.
Here's the thing. I think... A while ago, when Amazon bought Comixology, there was a big uproar about, Amazon ruining potentially a good thing.
Right.
There is a thing that exists on both the Prime Video app and the Comixology app that is just one extra step. It's not as easy as just clicking and purchasing and downloading. There's a little bit of a thing that happens.
Maybe Apple has restricted... I think that their deal with people that put apps in their store is that if you have in-app purchases, Apple gets to keep a piece.
Right.
Which is why the Amazon Prime Video app, you can buy digital copies of movies on Amazon, but you can't buy them within the app. You actually have to go in the browser onto Amazon.com.
Yeah, and that is the analog that's happening here with Comixology.
Fascinating stuff.
So, do you go way back with comic books, as a kid, sized and aged person? Were you a comics kid? Did you have a comic book shop that had a little shelf for you with pull titles?
I went to Dr. Comics and Mr. Games in Oakland, California, when I was a kid for my comic book.
God,
needs.
That is a great name for a comic shop. Jesus,
good stuff.
Mine was called Puss in Books, which was a bookstore with a bunch of cats running around in it.
Oh, man. How did you convince your parents to let you go in there?
I mean, I was and am allergic to cats, so it was not enough of a deterrent.
I was never a, I never followed any like mainline comics. I never followed a Marvel or a DC comic. And I think that the main reason why was that the books were always very short, and I didn't really understand the like collection thing. And yeah. I didn't ever feel like I could pick up a story at the beginning, and it just all, it felt very impenetrable to me. So the comics that I did like were kind of one-off, you know, comic books by sort of alt and indie comics artists. And then
you were a comics hipster even way back then.
Yeah, I think I think it was more just that like I felt like if I went to the indie comics section, I could pick up a book off the shelf and like I could absorb the entire work within the front and back cover of that book, whereas I didn't have a reliable way of convincing my parents to take me down there, you know, on a weekly basis to like follow a story, and I didn't have like a big brother to tell me how to do that. Right. So I think I became aware that like people arrange to have comic stores set aside every issue of a comic for them like a couple years ago. Like I had no idea that that was a thing, and it makes total sense. But like my parents didn't know shit about that and were only moderately supportive of my interest in like learning about comics. So yeah, all that said, like I've read like, you know, Akira and Ghost in the Shell. Like those are probably the like the biggest name comic books that I've read. And a bunch of weird like Johnny the Homicidal Maniac comics and stuff like that. But never I have not followed like this feels to me like a real comic in a way that I, which is not to say that those others aren't real comics, but it's not the kind of comic book I grew up reading.
That is so interesting to me that your interests were self-motivated due in part to just your independent study of it. I had a very different experience from my perspective. I had friends who were very into comics and friends with older brothers specifically who had very strong comic interests. And so by hanging around with them and playing role-playing games with them, in order to trade the currency of friendship at that age, like you have to have like interests. And so I became interested in reading Marvel comics and then later Image comics in order to like remain friends, really. Like you want to know about this stuff. And there was something about the collecting that really scratched that persnickety itch that I've had all my life, which is like the possession of the thing and keeping the thing nice while it's in my care. Like the thing about buying a comic book, reading the comic book, bagging the comic book, and storing the comic book. Like that is that's a very satisfying process to me for ways I can't quite articulate. You know, it's like people who have nice record collections or have nice baseball card collections or whatever you collect, there's that interest in keeping it nice and safe. And it also was a way to have a relationship with an adult business person that I think might be my first. Like when you go into a store and you talk to a shopkeeper, you sort of make an arrangement like, hey, I'm going to come back every month. And what's being offered here is a part of a shelf with my name on it that the shopkeeper will pick comics. And my part of the deal that I need to hold up is I need to visit every month and buy these things.
Keep my my allowance squared up for these.
Yeah. In many ways, comics. It's like the first contract I think I ever had with anyone.
Wow.
And it felt like adult, like a thing to go in and do. And that was a fun process for me.
You're a very precocious young man, Adam.
Not sure about that. But,
well, do you want to get into these comic books that we read?
Yeah, I think so. What we're reading today, or what we're reviewing today, are the first two Star Trek Discovery comics with the title Succession. And what makes these comics unique and important is that they may or may not be canon. And the reason that they may be canon is something that Ted Sullivan, one of the writers of Star Trek Discovery, has said about them. When asked, he said, I look at it this way, it's canon unless we do something that invalidates it on the show.
Yeah.
Which is sort of like a great position to take. So having none of this invalidated at this point in time, this being mid-season one and two, let's dig into the canonical implications of Star Trek Discovery Succession number one.
We have engaged the Klingons.
Klingons?
What the hell is going on this ship?
The slightest idea.
This first one opens on, like, MU, Lorca, and Burnham plotting before the events of the Discovery traveling to the Mirror Universe. Like, it's like a year ahead of the destruction of the Charon.
Right.
It's kind of like a lover's plot, right? Like, they're both nude, like, slinking around the bedroom, and it may be like a post-coital plot that they're discussing.
Some of the best plots.
I guess she gets undressed, though, so maybe it's a pre-coital. Maybe they're going to bang while enjoying, like, while reveling in their evil genius.
You know, pre-coital discharge can still get you pregnant, Ben.
Yeah, you got to be careful with that stuff. That's why the rhythm method doesn't always work.
Right.
Discovering each other through the discovery of ourselves, honestly.
It's fun to see them in an intimate scene. You know, this is something that was only alluded to on the show.
Right.
And alluded to in a way that made it filthy and bad because of their relationship. But
gross to contemplate.
Yeah, but to see them together and how much they enjoy each other's company, it's a totally different way to consider their relationship.
This also kind of renewed my curiosity about Prime Lorca, a character that we never met.
Right.
You know, I think all implications are that Prime Lorca is dead, but you know, you can never count on that in TV land.
Nope, sure can't. As long as a person's under contract.
I mean, it makes me excited that there's a potential Jason Isaacs cameo in season two, right?
Boy, I hope so. He's just the greatest. There's a really fun smash cut. Like, I feel like I'm gonna use a lot of TV and film terminology here with regard to transitions and compositions and stuff, mostly because I think that's a fairly accurate shorthand to use when we're talking about a visual medium. The last words in this scene are, "Nothing will ever come between us," and then smash cut to the destruction of the Charon.
And this is the ISS Shenzo pulling up to the Charon, and that's pretty fun stuff. Like, they are kind of still under the dubious impression that Michael Burnham left Lieutenant Detmer in charge. Mm-hmm. And Lieutenant Detmer, of course, is the lady who in the Prime Universe got her face blown apart in the Battle of the Binary Stars, but is an unblowed up character in the Mirror Universe.
What you get in this scene is more dialogue than Detmer and Owosakun have had in the entire season.
It's true. Like, it is a little bit of a one-note power struggle. Like, I guess they were both of the same rank, and Owosakun kind of resents that Detmer has assumed the command of the ship in the meantime. And we kind of come back to that a couple of times, but they're out here looking for survivors of the destruction of the flagship of the fleet.
That description of it being one note is really interesting to me, because I think what it does is describe how much harder a comic has to work to make the case for its characters and its motivations,
right,
than a TV show does. A TV show has the benefit of a musical score and expressions and the way that it can edit a scene to either raise or lower tension between people. So, I mean, the comic really relies heavily on the dialogue here.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't have any other tools.
I like the way it's paced, too. Like, there were definitely a couple of scenes where I was sitting there reading it wondering, like, what? Why am I even reading about this? Like, why do I care about what these characters are doing right here, right now? And
or who are these people?
But it always kind of revealed itself by the end of the scene. And I don't even know if you call it a scene in comics. I'm sure that there are comic people listening to this episode just tearing their hair out at how badly we're using the terminology.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can relate.
It's fun to see a fascist San Francisco.
Right. And the introduction of a brand new character, we get Prince Alexander, the surviving cousin of Emperor Georgiou.
Prince Alexander watched the film Blade and really just dug the haircut a lot. So that's the kind of haircut he's rocking.
Boy, I don't think we can talk too much about what Prince Alexander looks like, right? Because like all his ideas are scary and threatening, but he's so weird and nebbish looking.
Yeah, he's I kind of wonder like who you would cast in this part, because I mean there's characters in this that are based on characters in the show, and so they're drawn to look like the actors who portrayed them.
Yeah.
And then this guy we never see in the show.
I think those caricatures are really good, by the way.
Yeah. And he definitely like has a look, and
his look is Duran Duran to me. like super glossy. He looks a little androgynous for someone who has taken the stand of a form of purity that flexes like it would be masculine. You know what I'm saying?
Right. And he is surrounded by all these like noble men, and they've all got the like hard chest pieces that everybody wears. There's definitely like, I think that the nobility get like red elements, maybe. Mm-hmm. It's kind of interesting to think about how society is structured and how government is structured in the Terran Empire. But this dude has kind of taken the throne in the absence of anybody else that would be considered to be in the line of succession. He's Michael Burnham's cousin and is, you know, like Lorca was trying to take out Emperor Georgiou because he thought she was not hardline enough. This guy might be even more hardline than Lorca, because he is bent on a genocide, basically.
Yeah, he's not into the subjugation of these other races of people, but in their extermination, rather.
He's like an ethnic cleansing dude.
Right. Back on Kronos, we see Laurel, who is alive and still working with the Resistance.
Did we ever meet Mirror Universe Laurel?
I don't think we have. I don't think we have at all. She's grieving Voke's death on Harlac, though.
Right.
Which you might remember as Harlac was bombarded in orbit by the Charon.
Mm-hmm.
Along with Laurel is Amanda Grayson, the now widowed wife of Sarek.
And they're like sitting around the campfire plotting, how do we take advantage of this kind of gap in consistent Terran policy? You know, there's a succession taking place, which means there'll be some like inconsistent leadership and an untested new emperor. They don't even realize like how bad the new guy is. They're just trying to take advantage of the relative chaos, I guess, to press their advantage. And
right, they're used to predictable leadership, competent leadership, and then when you install this crazy person right after that, I think the rest of society can see that as something to take advantage of, especially when the new guy is a real idiot.
A really like emotionally impulsive idiot that is not really in possession of all of his faculties.
And a racist.
An ethnic cleansing type.
Right.
It's sort of setting this up as like two sides of a big conflict, but I think that even before this, like you've seen one of the noblemen on the Shenzhou getting killed by Detmer, and it shows that like the inherent chaos in the Empire, just like because of their kind of like killer be killed lifestyle, I feel like it's already pretty obvious that the chaos that the rebels are looking to exploit is not going to be the chaos that they think it is.
Right, because the baseline level of chaos in the Terran Empire is so high,
right,
that I feel like this only minimally moves the needle.
One fun character we get to meet also is Mirror Universe Commander Bob.
Right.
She is not quite as decorated in the Mirror Universe, but Bob is back, baby.
Yeah, and she's kind of the power behind the power, right? She works for Prince Alexander, and like to his face, shows allegiance, but really hates him and his methods, and is like pretty keen on undermining him when she gets the chance.
She uses a lot of the same kind of language with him that Michael Burnham and Lorca used with each other in that first scene.
Yeah.
But then, you know, when she's not in his presence, is actively working to undermine him. And he's doing that kind of that villain monologuing thing where he's showing her his giant holographic DNA strand. And my favorite quote from the comic book is, "Purity, thy name is human."
Hey, it looks like you're trying to exterminate a race of aliens.
We'll take these weapons and load them into your atmosphere.
In one sol period, your planet will be ready to take over.
Talk about a heavy period.
Mr. DNA with a menstruation joke. Mirror Universe Mr. DNA. Really off color with the humor, yeah.
A little bit problematic, yeah.
We have been waiting for someone worthy of our attention.
What? Who are you?
We've encountered them.
Those Klingons?
There's that balcony scene with Commander Bob and some other guy, like talking about the madness of wiping out all non-human species in the galaxy.
Yeah.
Did you think of this guy as potentially being a character that we need to keep track of, or is he just there for her to explain that she's not, as previously stated, on Emperor Alexander's side?
Well, I mean, his presence appears to be serving the utility of being someone that Cornwall can talk to. But the way comics work is that, like, you could go into Cornwall's head and have, like, squared off box dialogue that's just her thoughts. You don't need that to serve the exposition of the story.
Yeah.
So having said all that, I think I will err on the side of this being a character we need to know.
Yeah.
Back on the Shenzo, we have an Arum sighting.
Yeah, and I've never been entirely clear on what she is.
Yeah, and boy do we get some backstory here.
Yeah, we know that she is at least part human, based on the fact that she is involved with the Empire. Like, she's human enough that they don't consider her chattel or whatever, and she's got enough control to pump killer gas into the bridge and kill everybody.
Yeah, they depict her in profile in the first couple of frames, and it's a series of frames that show her putting on her mask.
It kind of transformers out of her face.
Yeah.
Her computer head.
She might be the most rugged of all the bridge crew that we've come to know. This Mirror Universe version of her is a badass.
No kidding. So what is she? Is she like the Million Dollar Man or whatever, where she's transhuman, that kind of augmented or something? Or
you don't really get the full backstory, but what you get is her resentful feelings about the unrevealed backstory. She mentions that, like, this is a crew full of people who have othered her in that way. And now, by taking command of the ship and gassing the bridge crew, she's getting her comeuppance. It does not seem like she can gas her way into acceptance, though. Like, her endgame is not going to have anything to do with carrying the water for the Terran Empire going forward, I don't think.
I like that she has a different font when she talks.
Me too.
From everybody else.
Yeah, that's fun.
And then we get a scene, just a little brief scene, on the surface of Risa, which in the Mirror Universe is a total hellhole and looks like a slum in some very hot and very impoverished place.
Instead of being like verdant and wet, it's so dry. It's not a fuck planet anymore. No one there seeks Jemaharon.
Nary a Horgon to be seen.
No.
But what there is to be seen is Harry Mudd. And he's kind of a humanitarian in this universe. He's bandaging up an Andorian who got her antenna damaged or cut off or something. And who does he meet but a cloaked Michael Burnham?
She's there to work out some kind of deal. That's the big reveal. That's the button on the comic, Ben.
It's a short little episode.
Yeah.
What do you think that is, about 5 minutes of showtime if they had shot this for Disco?
Yeah, because all of the scenes are only a couple of pages each.
I wonder, do you know in comic world how long a series is going to be? I saw that there's an announced third book to this series, but we only got books one and two, or issues one and two.
I don't know how it works, but based on what we're seeing here in the first comic, it seems like they are beginning a story that could last a long time.
Yeah.
We do an embarrassing Star Trek podcast, and a big part of our success is owning that, being ourselves in all our embarrassing glory. But what if we didn't? What if we were just a Star Trek podcast? No embarrassment, no comedy, just Star Trek podcast. If you're somebody who wants a website, you could go generic and bland and one size fits all on a social media platform, or you could buy a custom URL and design a custom website with Squarespace. Squarespace is the all-in-one platform for all kinds of people to stand out and succeed online. Squarespace makes it easy to create a beautiful website, engage with your audience, and sell anything from products to content to time, all in one place, all on your terms. So whoever you are, or whatever you're trying to do, own it with Squarespace. Go to squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/trek to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
It's Webby season. Hi, I'm Sequoia Holmes, host of the Black People Love Paramore podcast, and we are nominated for a Webby for the episode where I interviewed Hayley Williams. In case you're unfamiliar, Black People Love Paramore is a podcast delving into the common and uncommon interests of Black people in order to help us feel more seen. We would love your vote to help us win this Webby. Please take a second, go over to the Black People Love Paramore podcast social media accounts, and you can find them at BPLP Pod across all social media platforms. Hit the link in bio and vote for Black People Love Paramore.
Hi, I'm Travis McElroy.
And I'm Teresa McElroy.
And we're the host of Schmanners.
We don't believe that etiquette should be used to judge other people.
No, on Schmanners, we see etiquette as a way to navigate social situations with confidence.
So if that sounds like something you're into,
join us every Friday on Maximum Fun, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, Adam.
What's that, Ben?
Did you find yourself a drunk Shimoda in this comic?
Incredible!
Drunk Shimoda!
I did. It's going to be a visual Shimoda, obviously.
Okay. A time code Shimoda,
yeah,
as it were.
If you turn to page 2, and that's the second page after the comic actually starts, there's the top frame of Michael Burnham from behind sharing the frame with Lorca, and then the frames below that, there's a cut in frame of Lorca, and then next to that frame is a totally different frame with Michael Burnham from behind again,
yeah.
And it looks, the way that the frames are positioned, it suggests, like, the sexual position that it suggests kind of flies in the face of the comics code here. Like, are you seeing what I'm seeing? Like, if they were to occupy the same frame, it looks like some banging, but they're just talking to each other in a shot reverse shot kind of way. I feel like that's very intentional frame to frame composition there.
I think you're picking up what they're putting down.
Yeah. Yeah. What about you, Ben?
I had to give it to Detmer and Owosikun. They get a kind of co-Shimoda for being so caught up in their own little extremely trivial power struggle that they don't see Arium coming. You got to keep your head on a swivel in this lifestyle. And the fact that they're just kind of like lightly bickering about who should really be in charge the entire time is like, obviously they're not cut out for that captain's chair if they can't... they can't predict gas being pumped into the bridge.
Yeah, I agree. I think you need to see that one coming. If you've got a robot person on your bridge, I think you need to assume that the air can be taken out of the room at any point.
Indeed. Should we move on to Succession book two, issue two.
Yeah.
What? What's happening?
What's all this?
I'm trying to save you.
What is this?
This comic starts with a flashback scene of a young Michael Burnham sword training with Giorgio. And they don't practice with plastic weapons, Ben.
No. It's a very brutal approach to practice, you know, like at some point, Giorgio lets Michael Burnham practice with her palace guards. And she says, like, if you can kill them, they don't deserve to be my guards. And if they can kill you, you don't deserve to be my daughter. That's some fucked up shit.
Yeah, it's pretty rough.
We also get a little bit of young Alexander. And for all of Michael Burnham's Morrissey fan haircut in this scene, I think young Alexander is a big dubstep fan.
Right.
So they've really fallen on opposite sides of the musical issue.
They're also on opposite sides of the genealogy issue, because one of the ways that Prince Alexander, young Prince Alexander, bullies her is rubbing his lineage in her face. He's jealous of the attention that she gets, and the one way that he can get one up on her is by saying, you know, you're just adopted. You're never going to inherit the throne the way I will.
Yeah. I liked seeing this set against the backdrop of the San Francisco landmark, the Palace of Fine Arts.
Yeah.
I guess in this universe, it's the Palace of Martial Arts.
That's great, Ben.
That's why I get the big bucks, Adam.
Score one for you.
Back in the timeline of the present for these books, we got Burnham and Mud hanging around on Kronos, walking through the slummy environment, having a chat. Burnham is there to call due some favors that she feels like Mud owes her.
There's references to exchanges that they've made in the past, but Mud is sort of encouraging her to not pursue the throne. He's like, everyone thinks you're dead. I even thought you were dead up until a little while ago. Like, that's the ultimate freedom, right? Why don't you get out of here? But Michael Burnham isn't into this. She's got her eyes on the throne, and she needs his help to get it. She promises Mud that, like, once she's able to attain that status, it will be better for him in the long run.
It's kind of interesting to make this version of Michael Burnham a protagonist, right? Because she, as far as we know, roughly believes in the fairly brutal and awful dogma of the empire, right? She's just less awful than her cousin, who is a pretender to the throne.
Yeah, it's in the mirror universe, evil is really a matter of degree, isn't it?
You know, they say some people were born to be bad.
How do you feel about this person being our protagonist, you know? Like, Mud, I could see being the protagonist more than Better by Shades, evil Michael Burnham.
I think Mud himself in this comic says something to that degree. He's like, or is it Laurel? Michael Burnham is characterized in this comic to that degree, in that, you know, like, you work for the Terran Empire, you've done some terrible shit to our people, why should we help you?
Right.
And so that question seems very related to the one that you're asking me, and I'm not sure I have an answer for you.
No, I don't know that the comic does yet. I would hope that that's something that they find a way to resolve.
If Burnham attains the throne and then presents an evil plan that is only two clicks less awful than the one that Prince Alexander has, then what's the point?
It's not going to be genocide. It's just going to be slavery, guys.
Yeah. That's not even close to genocide. You all get to live.
So back on Earth in the Alexander throne room, Commander Bob is doing a little presentation on the genocide scheme that is well underway. It is the ships are being loaded with this toxin, right?
Yeah, things came together pretty quickly.
And she shows a hologram of what I'm pretty sure is the Stargazer, which is an interesting little tie-in to the TNG Mirror Universe comics.
Yeah, it kind of looks like the same class, doesn't it?
If not the exact same ship.
Alexander is super pumped about this.
He's a really classic mustache twirling villain, isn't he?
Right. Yeah.
No shades of gray with Alexander.
No, not at all. And Cornwall presents this news update with all the commitment of just a person doing it for the paycheck, you know?
Right. She a bit betrays her lack of entire devotion to Alexander here, but...
Yeah, she's not enthusiastic about this plan.
She's thinking, like, why don't we do some tests on some Alderaan scale planets before we ramp it up to our, you know, your big Corellian scale planets.
I get those references.
He's not into that. He wants to do the whole shebang all at once.
There's a really nice crosscut here between this scene and the Shenzo, where Captain Arium has taken delivery of this payload.
They're at one of those space stations. I think we saw one of these, like, with Klingon tags all over it on the show. And she's taking the payload and then taking out the station, which has the effect of destroying all of the ships at dock as well. Pretty rugged move. Pretty low blow. She really shoots him in the back, you know?
Yeah, and the bridge crew that she has assembled of her new believers, to them she promises to enrich herself and them if they obey her.
Who is going to pay them if everybody's dead?
I know. That part's weird. She has a little monologue about how pissed she is about being deemed impure.
Yeah, she's got an axe to grind.
And this appears to be the start of a vengeance mission for her, which is fun.
It's fun. It also makes her a really interesting chaos agent in the story, because we're building this very existential scale fight between the Rebellion and the Empire that involves two pretty knowable sides, and then she's in here cruising around in a very capable ship with a very unknowable agenda.
Yeah, that part is very fun.
We have engaged the Klingons.
Klingons? Klingons? Those are Klingons?
What the hell is going on this ship?
I have no idea.
What is this?
Back on Kronos, the people have started to notice that that the Terrans are leaving in kind of large numbers, and that's creeping them out.
They're like, I was looking at a house recently. It's like, there's no demand for these things. You can make an offer at the posted selling price, and they will accept it.
So, Ben, I was out back getting tortured for a while, and then the guy torturing me just kind of took off. So after about 2 hours, I left, and here I am. You think that's weird?
Wonder what happened to that guy.
Anyway, can you rub this ointment on me?
You know, it's like when you're at a bar and they change shifts and you feel bad because you didn't get to tip the server from before. I just didn't know how to feel about it.
I still have like 2 fingernails left that haven't been pulled out of my hands. I mean, I expected him to finish the job. It's a little out of character.
So Laurel is looking to do some governor killing. They're heading to their campfire to meet up and talk about it when she walks in and finds Michael Burnham there. And she's like getting ready to do like mechleth to the neck on Michael Burnham. You know, Sarek's wife has to kind of like talk her down off of the murder cliff. They sit down with Michael Burnham and hear her out. And she winds up seeming a lot more reasonable than your average evil Mirror Universe character. She's like, hey, listen, like, I know that Emperor was bad, but, like, what you don't understand is that she was a fairly moderate Imperial.
It's another scene that underscores that the restraint that Michael Burnham has emotionally is what makes her so dangerous in this universe.
I think the Rebels have talked about the idea that the Empire might be looking to do a multiple species xenocide. But it's been kind of cast aside as an implausible idea because the Empire loves subjugating people.
Yeah.
And Michael Burnham is here to tell them, like, no, in fact, that is what they're doing. And, like, if you guys will help me, I will help you. And I'll help you first. I'll help you take out the Imperial governor of Kronos by sneaking you into the castle.
It's such a hollow promise, though. And this is This is the second such scene in these last two comics that make me feel this way. Like, what does the newly discovered living Michael Burnham have to promise anyone? Like, it doesn't make her goal of getting the throne any more or less effective if no one knows she's alive, but that's what she's promising.
I also don't really understand, like, what specifically she does for them in this palace raid scene. Like, she is on the raid with them, but it doesn't, they don't show her doing anything that anybody else couldn't do to get them in there.
It seems like an arrangement based purely on reputation than right. than anything else.
And it doesn't even work, you know. They get into the palace and are attempting to kill the governor, but, you know, he's prepared a beam out ahead of time, so it's not effective. And the last shot of the comic is of the ISS Constellation, I guess, poised to drop this dispersal drone to kill all non-human life on the planet.
Yeah, they're going to have to get the hell out at the beginning of issue 3, I think.
Or keep their fingers crossed that the reports of the testing on this weapon bearing out, having been cooked or something like that.
Or maybe the chaos agent that is the Shenzhou will arrive on the scene and give them some cover. Who knows?
Who knows?
Ben, did you like these two comics?
I did, and it's hard for me to read these without comparing them to show.
Yeah.
I think of this as being just like a, you know, like a 5-minute episode of the TV show in a way.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's good, but not great. But I do really like taking the boggle game of these characters and shaking them up and looking at what the mirror universe versions of everybody is up to. It provides kind of an interesting lens through which to view them. And I like these characters, and I've been curious about some of the deck, the bridge characters. And so, yeah, for those reasons, I did really enjoy this experiment. How about you?
I like these two issues specifically, but generally, a comic format grants a ton of latitude, because with a comic book, you don't have a budgetary restraint. So when Aram destroys that starbase, like you can destroy set pieces in a comic in a way that you can't do on TV. And right. so the comic book sandbox allows you a scale to your storytelling that is really without limits. And it's something that that excites me going forward, especially if these are seen as canonical stories to the greater Star Trek Discovery universe. Yeah. I think you could do some crazy, unexpected things here.
I'm a little sad that the Charon is already explode in this timeline, because that's one ship that I very keenly felt the budget didn't really allow them to show much of.
Yeah.
In the show. Like, I would love to see, I mean, that's a huge ship. What's going on in there?
Yeah.
Just a bunch of junk in space in this story.
Yeah, interesting time to be in the mirror universe. But did you find yourself a drunk Shimoda?
Incredible!
Drunk Shimoda!
Yeah, I think the governor of Kronos probably would be my Shimoda.
Yeah?
Because he's kind of, he does that thing like, I thought you'd never arrive, like,
yeah, just
you're too
waiting.
Late. Like, you know, he knows he's going to get beamed out, but what assurance does he have that he can get beamed out quick enough not to get phasered? I don't know. And it's not like he's just there to taunt them. Like, why did you stick around to do that? Who cares?
Yeah, he's portrayed as a little more omnipotent than a typical governor of Kronos should be depicted. His plan is engineered for maximum drama and not maximum logic.
Was this guy the same dude who was like an aide to Giorgio in that first scene just years later?
Oh, shit. I didn't
like
put that together.
A bald man. He's got same hairline, but he's grown a goatee maybe. I don't know if it's the same guy.
I did not put that together. remains to be seen, because we'll be seeing more of him, certainly.
I mean, there's no hint of, like, recognition between Burnham and him in this scene, so...
Right.
But maybe, like, was there, like, something about that's why she was able to get them in?
Yeah. We'll find out in issue 3.
How about you? Did you have a drunk Shimoda?
Yeah, it was another visual for me. On page 7, it looks like the kids playing soccer are kicking a little BB-8 around.
I saw that too. I wondered if that was an intentional dunk on
that's got to be
on Star
it, right?
Wars.
It's got to be. I don't think you draw something that looks that much like BB-8 and not have a message you're trying to send in so doing. So
yeah,
just kicking BB-8 around like a piece of junk.
Well, that was a fun little experiment. I think there's an entire completed story arc of comics that's already out. Like, this is another not knowing much about comics thing, is like I can't figure out what is what when I look online at what is available.
Well, maybe this will be the start for us of getting back into comics.
Yeah, if anybody out there has read other Star Trek Discovery comics and wants to suggest something to us, I'd be very curious to hear those suggestions.
My people were biologically determined for one purpose alone, to sense the coming of death.
What?
To sense the coming of death.
This doesn't make any sense.
I sense it coming now.
None of it makes any sense.
Sounds like nonsense to me.
Well, Adam, one other thing I wanted to talk about briefly before we go today is I was on the internet and discovered an article where they showed the original loaf design on Saru. They even put Doug Jones in this loaf and like did some screen tests, and it's pretty wild shit. It's kind of like an upside down Delta with maybe like 8 or 10 creepy goat eyes on it.
Yeah, to me, it kind of looked like a Gibson Flying V guitar.
I really like seeing it, and it's fun to imagine. I mean, the thing about Saru is that he's a character that we wind up needing to relate to on a kind of human level.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that would have been a harder bridge to cross if he looked this non-human.
Right. You know, that's a great point. Like, you make it harder to root for someone if there's less of yourself to see in them. And
right.
There's, like, essential humanity poking through Doug Jones's portrayal of Saru as currently envisioned. And I think that is a thing that helps a viewer identify with him and like him on that
right.
level. Though, I mean, who knows? Maybe they would be able to get around that having seen an entire season of Flying V-Face Saru, but...
Yeah. The photos also show him in a earlier iteration of the uniforms from the show, which is also pretty fun to see. It's kind of... A lot of the shape elements are there, but the color is really different. And also the... I don't know if it's actually Jug Jones or another actor, but the person wearing this loaf is just wearing some, like, New Balance jogging sneakers. It's pretty fun to see. Yeah. Well, anyways, Adam, I think we can call it there. Not much more disco news this week to discuss. But we'll be back in a couple weeks. We are now a fortnightly podcast.
That's what that means. So every other Tuesday, we'll be back here talking to you about the newest and best in off-season Star Trek Discovery news and dabbling in some comic books when we can and interviewing some super fun guests about the show, both what we've already seen and what we hope to see going forward.
We'll leave it with Rob from here, so thanks for listening.
The Greatest Discovery is a Maximum Fun podcast hosted by Adam Pranica and Ben Harrison, and it's produced and edited by me, Rob Schulte. Our music is by Adam Ragusea. So head on over to MaximumFun.org to support the ongoing production of our show, or you can leave us a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts. You can find Ben on Twitter at BenjaminAHR, Adam is at CutForTime, and I'm at Rob K. Schulte. We'll see you next time.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture. Artist owned.
Listener supported.